Good morning and welcome to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich on this extremely cold day when one might well wonder if the sun has forgotten entirely about us. Doug Duncan is here to remind us of our intimate relationship to the nearest star. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Gretchen.
We have all sorts of sun-related topics to talk about, and I was thinking this morning as I was driving in that this was a sort of an anti-sun day because when I was driving in this morning, I was experiencing only the sort of negative effects of the sun. It was not warming me in the least, obviously. It couldn't possibly have battled the cold temperatures and the wind chill this morning. And pretty much it just made my eyes water the whole way to work.
And, you know, it's sort of an amazing thing, but I bet most people don't know that when it's nice and clear like it is this morning, that it's even colder than if it clouded over right now. And
the clouds would trap some of the warmth?
They do, and they do in sort of a funny way. The clouds are part of the greenhouse effect. And what clouds do and what the Earth's atmosphere does to a certain extent is it traps infrared light, which is what we perceive as heat. So even on a clear day, let's say it's clear and dry, all right, the visible light from the sun comes in and it's absorbed by the ground, and the ground re-radiates that heat or re-radiates that energy. Now, the ground, of course, is not as hot as the sun is, and most of the energy coming out of the ground is infrared, which we can't see, although if you use a special camera, and ComEd has these cameras nowadays, you point it at a house or at the ground, and you can see all the heat waves of infrared coming out. Hmm. Well, now, clouds and moisture are not transparent to the infrared, and so they help trap it, and they help warm up the Earth. So when there's clouds, when there's a lot of moisture in the air, you actually stay warmer because whatever sunlight hits the ground and is re-radiated gets trapped and heats you up. And people think of the greenhouse effect as something bad typically nowadays. But sometimes you'd like more. It has its upside. If you lived on Mars, one of the big fascinating questions nowadays is, was Mars warmer in the past? And we know that Mars is a relatively small planet, doesn't have such strong gravity. Little by little, it's been losing its atmosphere. So if you went back a couple of billion years when Mars had more atmosphere, it had more greenhouse effect, and it definitely was warmer. So Mars was more hospitable, and there was just news on the wire services this morning, I noticed, about pretty strong-looking evidence for lakes. You know, it looks like the shores of ancient
standing bodies of water.
Yeah, on Mars. And that makes sense if Mars was warmer in the past, and the reason was it had a better greenhouse effect.
Now, I know you're not a meteorologist, but why don't you play one on the radio for a moment? is the converse true? In other words, if there were more clouds, we would stay warmer. But is that why it seems, I haven't documented this, but it seems that the most freakishly cold days are always extremely clear and extremely bright?
Absolutely.
Okay, yep. So it couldn't actually get that cold if we had clouds.
Correct. A little bit of cloud cover and a little bit of moisture always warms you up.
Okay, well, that's one of the joys of living in Chicago.
Yes, if it
bright,
makes
sunny,
any
blue skies and 80 below.
If it makes any listeners feel better, the University of Chicago Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics specializes in research at the South Pole. And the reason we take some of our telescopes down to the South Pole, some of them are looking in the infrared, and it's so dry and cold at the South Pole that any moisture in the air precipitates out and it's completely clear. And so you can see the infrared. It doesn't get trapped by the atmosphere, but you are awfully cold when you're seeing it.
All right. Well, I think we're sort of getting a feel for what it's like to do astronomy at the South Pole today, Doug.
And then soon we'll talk about the North Pole on this show, Gretchen. So I hope this helps.
We'll cover everything, pole to pole. Let's talk about an eclipse, Doug, one of your favorite things to talk about. We have a partial eclipse coming up on Christmas Day.
Isn't this something? I think most people don't know about this yet, but a substantial eclipse of the sun happens right here in Chicago on Eclipse Day. It starts about 9:45 in the morning, and a little bite will be taken out of the edge of the sun. After about an hour and a half, it'll be at maximum eclipse, and a little over half of the sun will be covered by the moon. After about another hour and a half, the sun will be completely uncovered. So more than half of the sun will be covered over right from here in Chicago. Every place in the continental United States will see this eclipse. So if you have relatives, tell them about the eclipse too.
What time?
It'll be early morning on the West Coast, mid-morning here in Chicago, and start around noon on the East Coast.
Now, if the moon is covering 50% of the sun,
mm-hmm.
does that mean that there is 50% less sunlight? Does it work exactly like that?
It does. Just okay. Think, we can be even colder.
But now, what does 50% less sunlight feel like? Will there be a noticeable difference in the quality of the light?
Surprisingly enough, there will not. And that's because your eye is a remarkable, remarkable organ, remarkable sensor. If you looked at three or four rooms, let's say, and it looked to your eye as if one room is twice as bright as the other, and the next room is three times as bright, and four times as bright, and five times as bright, if you actually used a light meter, which is quantitative, which your eye is not, you would find the brightness of those rooms was in the ratio 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. Huh, there's a pattern there.
Mm-hmm.
So things that you would guess are maybe four or five times as bright are 100 times as bright. So your eye is remarkably sensitive over a wide range.
Hmm.
The flip side of that is, if you change the brightness of the sun by only 50%, your eye will hardly notice that. So no listener should expect it to be dark on Christmas mid-morning when the eclipse happens. You won't have a general sensation. The only way that you can see the eclipse, which is quite fun to do, is to take some special precaution and look at it.
Okay, such as eclipse glasses?
Eclipse glasses are a very easy way. Probably a lot of listeners have seen those. They're sort of Mylar futuristic-looking glasses. I'm very happy to be able to say that the Chicago Sun-Times has 600,000 of these eclipse glasses, and they're going to put them in the Sunday Sun-Times a week before the eclipse on December 17th. And I'm also happy to say I helped arrange for 100,000 of these to go to Chicago public school kids. So they will all be getting glasses, everyone in 4th and 7th grade in Chicago. They'll have to share them with their parents. For any other listeners, the Sun-Times will have these, and also the Learning Express stores, which have sort of scientific kinds of things, are going to have these glasses.
Okay, and if you don't have glasses,
well, there's
an
even better way, actually, better than the glasses. If you have access to a pair of binoculars, you can do something totally cool to look at the sun any day, not just eclipse day. Now, of course, you don't want to look, through binoculars at the sun. That would burn your eyes. But if you let the binoculars look at the sun all by themselves, the sunlight will go in the front of the binoculars and out the eyepiece, acting just like a projector. And you hold a piece of white paper about a foot behind the binoculars and focus the eyepiece, and you'll get a nice, bright, 3 or 4 or 5 inch diameter picture of the sun. I did that yesterday. The sun was covered with sunspots. You can see them, perfectly, perfectly well.
Wow.
The only trick is holding the binoculars steady. Some binoculars can be attached to a tripod like a photographer would use, and otherwise I prop them up on a table or anything handy that holds the binoculars steady. Now, to get them to point at the sun, don't look through them at the sun. You can look at the shadow of the binoculars on the ground, and when you minimize the shadow, the binoculars are pointing toward the sun, and out the eyepiece comes this nice, bright, projected image of the sun. Focus it on the paper and see the sunspots.
Now, presumably it's a curved line where the edge of the moon,
mm-hmm.
the line along the edge of the moon. Is it perfectly crisp? I mean, could you see contours along
the moon? If you look real closely, sometimes you can see little mountains sticking up on the edge of the moon.
Wow.
Absolutely. Now, if you don't have binoculars and you don't have the eclipse glasses, you can do one of two things. You can poke a little hole with the point of a pen, call it a pinhole, and a piece of paper, and let the sun go through that and hold another piece of paper maybe a foot behind the first piece, and you'll have a teeny tiny round pinhole image of the sun, but sure enough, you'll see a bite taken out of that.
Now, will that be in focus?
When the image is that small, it doesn't really matter that it's not quite in good focus. Now, I invented this over the weekend. I was trying this, and it's disappointing to have such a small image of the sun. And I realize not everybody has binoculars or these eclipse glasses, although with 600,000 coming, thanks to our friends at the Sun-Times, it shouldn't be too hard to get them. But I tried taking a paper punch, that punches a hole like you'd put in a three-ring binder. And then I took a small mirror, like you'd use to get in a cosmetic kit or something. And I took this piece of paper with the maybe quarter of an inch hole punched in it, and I put it over the mirror. And that allowed me to have a little round reflecting mirror the size of a hole punch.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went outside, and you find any building, find the north side of it. Like I went outside my garage. And the north side of a building is always in shadow this time of the year because the sun is to the south. So I took this little mirror, and I bounced an image of the sun onto the wall of the garage. And that made an image of the sun maybe an inch in diameter. And you could see the eclipse when there's going to be an eclipse just fine using that technique. So a pinhole mirror, projection with the binoculars, that's the best, or a pair of eclipse glasses.
All right. And how long will it last?
About,
an hour and a half?
About 3 hours total.
Okay.
An hour and a half into the middle of the eclipse and an hour and a half back out.
Okay.
Now, just to make it really clear for people, we should probably say that the, a half eclipse is not half as good as a total eclipse. Okay? Regular listeners to this program may recall the rather extraordinary tape that we played maybe mm-hmm. half a year of people just screaming and crying and cursing. When a total eclipse comes, that's amazing. That transforms your sight. In fact, one of the two or three most spectacular things I've ever seen in my life is a total eclipse of the sun. The next total eclipse doesn't happen until next June, and that happens in Africa. So you can't just wait here in Chicago for a total eclipse, I'm afraid.
We'll have to content ourselves with a partial eclipse. But the sun, lots of other interesting things are happening at the sun right now. The sun is at the peak of an 11-year cycle. It's at solar max. What does that mean,
right.
Doug?
There's a sunspot cycle. This was discovered about a century after Galileo became the first person to look at the sun with a telescope. As you may know, Galileo discovered the sunspots. People didn't believe him. He looked at the sun with his little telescope, which wasn't too good for his eyes, but he would look at sunrise and sunset when the sun wasn't too bright. By the way, I don't recommend that, listeners. We have filters nowadays, which Galileo didn't have. But at any rate, he found spots on the sun. We now know that those are regions of strong magnetic fields, and they're cooler than the rest of the sun, and so they look dark. About a century, I believe, after Galileo, a German amateur astronomer, I like this story because astronomy is one of the few sciences where an amateur can actually make really important discoveries. Last time I heard, there are not amateur brain surgeons.
They're and not, that's just as well.
Perhaps. Not even amateur particle physicists, I don't think. But there are plenty of amateur astronomers, and a German pharmacist by the name of Heinrich Schwabe was looking with his 3-inch diameter telescope. So just a nice little telescope in his backyard. He looked almost every clear day, and he kept track of how many spots were on the sun. And after 11 years, he discovered that there is a big cycle, that every 11 years there's lots of spots on the sun, and in the in-between years, not very much.
What are the spots?
Well, it was discovered just this century that the sun has a magnetic field like the Earth has a field that points all our compass needles toward north. The sun has 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 times stronger magnetic field, and the sunspots are regions of very strong field. Now, the sun's surface is hot enough that most of the gases, hydrogen for instance, are what's called ionized, and that means that the proton and electron that make up hydrogen are separated. The electron has so much energy it flies away from the proton, and so the gas on the surface of the sun is charged, either plus or minus. If there's a strong magnetic field, plus or minus charged things get bent, or that you can't really move freely when there's a magnetic field. And so, wherever there's a sunspot in a strong magnetic field, the movement of the gases is inhibited. Now, what is heat? Heat at the molecular level is things moving around very fast. So if you inhibit the motion of a gas, you essentially cool it. And so the magnetic fields in sunspots are associated with regions of cooler gas. It's not moving around as much. And by comparison to the rest of the sun, it looks very dark. If you could take a sunspot and lift it off the sun and put it out in space, it would look plenty bright. It would just look like a little star or something.
Mm-hmm.
But compared to the rest of the sun, those sunspots are dark. They're not as energetic. They're not as hot. The sunspots I was seeing with the binoculars, like we talked about, were about the size of the Earth.
Wow.
Okay, the sun is 100 times the Earth's diameter, and there are some big spots on the sun nowadays. Now, of course, the other thing that's interesting is since the time of Heinrich Schwabe, we've learned it's not just spots. Whenever the sun reaches the maximum, which we nowadays call solar maximum, or if you go to the IMAX at the Museum of Science and Industry right now, for short, it's called Solar Max. Incredible things happen. The sun always has a solar wind, and that is some particles coming off the sun into space. But at solar maximum, there are flares, which are enormous eruptions, explosions on the sun. They release enormous amounts of energy and actual physical material that shoots through space, and some of that stuff hits the Earth.
And so that's going on all the time, but we're just getting a lot of it right now?
A lot of it. And when the stuff hits the Earth, lots of things happen.
Okay, wait, what is it, though, that's hitting the Earth?
It's mostly, well, it's two kinds of things. Either radiation, like X-rays, ultraviolet, gamma rays, things which can burn your skin, cause mutations, bad for you if you're out in space. And of course, we have some astronauts out in space. And the other stuff is actual atoms, physical stuff that comes through hydrogen that's shot through space, and that hits the Earth, too.
Okay, we'll talk about that some more. We're going to take a quick break right now, and then when we come back, we'll talk some more with Doug Duncan and also take some phone calls at 312-832-3124. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the Chicago Historical Society with an invitation to meet Carl Anthony, who will discuss and sign his book as a presidential insider. Anthony seeks to unveil the real stories of America's own royal families. On Thursday, December 7th, 6 p.m., Clark Street at North Avenue. Information is available at 312-642-4600. If you made a membership gift to WBEZ this year, you may be eligible to double your gift. Many companies match their employee contributions. We hope you'll take a moment to check with your human resources department to find out if your membership contribution to WBEZ is eligible for a match. Thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's B-movie material informed by art house sensibility. We'll talk with the film's director, Ang Lee, and one of the stars, Michelle Yeoh. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
You can hear Fresh Air each weekday afternoon at 2 o'clock on Chicago Public Radio, 91.5 FM. That's Fresh Air, today at 2 on WBEZ Chicago.
You're listening to Odyssey on Chicago Public Radio, 91.5 FM, WBEZ Chicago. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Doug Duncan is here today, and we're talking about the sun and solar max and a partial eclipse on Christmas morning. But I do want to let listeners know that we may be cutting away shortly to NPR's coverage of the legal appeal by the Al Gore team to the Florida Supreme Court of yesterday's decision in Florida Circuit Court. So it's possible that we will be going to that coverage. But in the meantime, we will continue to talk about the sun and all these particles that are hitting the Earth as we speak. Doug, first, before we go on, you have all sorts of interesting sun information on your website.
Especially with this eclipse coming up and with these extraordinary pictures of material coming off the sun. I thought it would be nice to put it on the web. This is linked to the Odyssey homepage, which I'll let you give, but my own homepage is http://astro.uchicago.edu/Duncan.
And you can get to it from our website at wbez.org and then click on Today on WBEZ. It's up in the left-hand corner of the website. And there are all sorts of interesting, you can get to all sorts of interesting pictures of the sun.
As well as information about the eclipse in Chicago, when it starts and stops in different cities, things like that.
Okay, let's return for a moment to the bombardment that we are currently undergoing, which we didn't even know. I didn't know.
You know, people don't know it's the bombardment that's causing this, but there's something noticed all over the world at this time, especially in the north, and that is the extraordinary phenomenon of the aurora, the northern lights. And I personally wait with great anticipation, believe it or not, for the solar maximum every 10 or 11 years, because I've had the good fortune to lead sort of an educational trip each time the sun reaches maximum up to the north to see the northern lights. I did that last March, and I'm going to do it again this March, and it was just unbelievable how intense these lights were. If you live up there, you know, it's probably like living next to the Sears Tower. It doesn't impress you. But for somebody from the south, I've never seen anything like it. Rivers of light streaming, waving back and forth across the sky. An absolutely unbelievable sight. And Of course, it's cold up there, and if you come along on a trip like this, you need to be prepared. Like you would go skiing or something like that. And in fact, some pictures from last year I've posted on my website. And
I've seen those pictures.
They do as good a job as a still picture can ever do of a very dynamic and moving, in both senses of the word, phenomenon. I actually tried to take a video of the aurora. I don't know if I told you. I don't think
I told you
nor our listeners about this. Once again, our eyes are phenomenal. They can see a wide range of brightness from the day to the night. So it turns out that your eye and listeners' eyes do much better than video cameras at night. And I guess if you've tried to use your home video, you know that take a picture at night, it's tough. Things look grainy, they look black and white. I went all the way to the makers of video cameras, and I said, do you make any kind of a special video camera to use at night? Take a nice color picture of the aurora. And I learned, yes, they do. Hitachi Company, which is who I talked to, said that for a mere $750,000, they'll give me the special color nighttime camera, of which they have made two.
A good stocking stuffer.
Right. One for the University of Alaska, which makes the only video of the Northern Lights I've seen. And Hitachi would not tell me who they sold the other camera to. But for $750,000, I decided I would just go up there
and take your chances
and see it. And I do hope listeners will log onto these web pages and look, because it's extraordinary.
Okay, let me give our number again. 312-832-3124 is our number. What else does this bombardment do? What other effect does it have on the Earth when Solar Max comes around and all these things?
Well, nowadays that we are so high tech with satellites out there and with a lot of people depending on communication, it can be a real problem. At the last solar maximum 11 years ago, a particularly strong surge from the sun knocked out the electrical power grid of all of eastern Canada. Obviously, it would be very unfortunate if we were to lose a substantial part of our power grid, but the surge was so strong it caused a surge in the wires. Transformers burned out, shorted. We have enough of this in the summertime in Chicago, right, without help from the sun. It could do that. It can affect satellites, can affect astronauts, as we mentioned. It also, and this is quite controversial, probably affects our climate. We now have, it doesn't have a dramatic effect. Even when the sun is covered with spots, the amount of the surface that's covered is less than 1%. On the other hand, you might say, what would happen if the sun got 1% cooler? Or 1% less energy? The answer is it would have a major impact on our climate. If day after day the sun's brightness changed by 1% and it was in the cool direction, it probably would push us toward an ice age. Now, I hasten to add that we have satellites now up there that are monitoring the sun to see what happens at solar maximum. And somewhat to our surprise, when the sun gets a lot of spots, it gets brighter. And the net energy, the total energy coming out of the sun, actually increases by a few tenths of a percent. And that's
why.
Well, all of these other eruptions and hot gas regions on the sun apparently more than compensate for the cool sunspots. So the sun's energy balance is not quite 100% secure. And every 10 years it does change a little bit. Even more fascinating, there is some evidence that in the 1600s, for a century, the sun may have changed its energy balance by several tenths of a percent. And that is because for almost a century after Galileo looked at the sun and before Heinrich Schwabe found the sunspot cycle, there were almost no spots on the sun for a whole century.
How do you know that? Was someone looking?
Well, at first this was poo-pooed. And astronomers said, oh, it's probably because telescopes were pretty lousy. Galileo was really good. Okay, he could see the sunspots. But all those people who came after Galileo for a century, they just weren't any good, and the spots were probably there. But then somebody thought to check the historical records of auroras and when various lakes would freeze. And that kind of data, if you probe archives here and there, you can find. And it seems like for that whole century, there were relatively few auroras noted, whereas before and afterwards, they're there in the historical record. And as a matter of fact, there is even, I've heard this indirectly from another astronomer, fascinating evidence that Louis XIV think that was the right king, was disappointed at how cold Versailles was and put in an order for extra tapestries because this period of time coincided with something in Europe called the Little Ice Age,
mm-hmm.
which climatologists, as best they can determine, say was a time of average temperatures a couple of degrees lower than otherwise. And you see, this corresponds with the modern measurements that more sunspots, the sun is hotter. No sunspots for a century, the sun would have been a little bit cooler, at least the net energy from it would have been a little less. So the historical evidence for the Little Ice Age and what we observe with satellites on the sun seems to match.
Well, why would the sun go for a whole century without any spots?
Great question. Nobody knows. Some of my original research that I did in the 1980s at Mount Wilson Observatory out in California, we found sunspot cycles on other stars. And we were trying, of course, to find out why is it every 11 years the sun has a lot of activity and then the spots and the other activity goes away. We found a good thing and a bad thing for a scientist wanting to make a discovery. The bad thing was other stars do have sunspot cycles. It's hardly ever 11 years. Some have 8, some have 5, some have 20, some have no cycles at all. So we did not learn why the spots come and go every 11 years. However, we did learn what it is that causes the spots, the ultimate cause of them, and that is the rotation of the star. It works up a dynamo inside the star, and that generates the magnetic fields. We found that every single star like the sun that was young, that was just born, that was up there in the Orion Nebula or the Pleiades or something like that, where we see young stars, those stars were rotating in 3, 4, 5 days, always had lots of spots and lots of magnetic fields. Our sun rotates in about 25 days. And if we do what I suggested to listeners earlier, set up binoculars and project an image of the sun and see the spots, you'll see that. You'll see every couple of days the spots are marching across the edge of the sun. You can make a little drawing, put an X where the spots are, and tomorrow they'll be moved over, and the next day they'll be moved over, and in 25 days it goes all the way around. But the young stars rotate much faster, have lots of spots, lots of X-rays, lots of ultraviolet, all these eruptions. In fact, the one time that I first corresponded with Carl Sagan, for whom I had much admiration, was when he wrote me and asked if our discoveries about the young stars having lots of spots and X-rays and ultraviolet would have happened in the early solar system and would have affected the origin of life.
And you said?
I said they did happen in the early solar system. Everything we know says the sun is like other similar stars. But as for the origin of life, you ought to find a biologist.
Well, now, Doug, how long does it take for a spot to form and how long does it last?
They generally pop to the surface within a day.
Wow.
You know, if you're watching
just
the sun
boom,
closely, there was nothing
there,
and you start to see a little bit of tiny spots come up, and by the next day or the day after that, you'll see a big region of several sunspots. And then they last for 2 or 3 months. Typically.
Mm-hmm.
We did find one star.
So you could see them on several rotations of the sun.
Absolutely.
Same spots.
We found one star in our Mount Wilson work that had the same spot last for 10 years.
Mm.
But the sun has never done that.
All right. I want to take some phone calls, but before we do, I have one final question, and that is, we've talked before on this program about neutrinos coming from the sun and attempts to measure them and see how they are transformed in their voyage from the sun to us.
Mm-hmm.
Is the quantity or quality of neutrinos coming from the sun affected by these cycles?
My goodness, that is an excellent question. I don't believe the answer is known. It is certainly not known to me. But I think the reason the answer is not known is it's been hard enough to measure the neutrinos so far that the accuracy of measurement is probably not enough to reveal a subtle change that would come and go with the 11-year cycle. But here's something else which is interesting, and that is it takes energy, like a photon of light, about 100,000 years to get from the center out to the surface and then go through space for us to see. So the stuff that's happening on the surface of the sun and the stuff that's happening down in the core are a little bit unconnected from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that if something did affect the center of the sun and was going to make the sun cooler, we would actually not notice that for about 100,000 years.
Huh.
So there's a bit of a disconnect between the middle and the surface.
All right, let's take some phone calls, Doug. 312-832-3124 is our phone number. Let's talk with George. Good morning, George. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hi. Before I get to my questions, a brief story. Back in the 1980s, my younger brother and I were driving across the Dakotas in the middle of the night. And after the sunset, we got disoriented because we thought that was the diminishing light in the western horizon was to our right, and we thought we were supposed to be heading into it to the west, and we couldn't figure out from the map why we weren't going in the direction that we thought we were supposed to be going. So we pulled off at a gas station and asked the guy for directions, and he looked at us really weird, and he said, "You know those lights up in the sky?" And we go, "Yeah." He said, "Where are you boys from?" We said, "We're from Chicago." And he said, "Well, ain't you city folk ever seen the northern lights? You know, the Aurora Borealis."
Wow. Wow.
So then we ran outside, and we got away from the lights of the gas station and a mile down the road and got out and looked at it. Went, "Ah, that's what that is." And they were beautiful.
That's a great story. You know, I would predict that even in Chicago, right now at Solar Maximum, we'll get one or two displays to come down to here this year. But it still is not at all like being completely surrounded and overwhelmed by them up north.
So, two quick questions. One, as I understand it, the space station, now that it has its solar panels extended, will be the third brightest object in the night sky after the moon, and I can't remember the name of the brightest star.
Probably Venus.
Okay, maybe the fourth brightest object in the night sky. Anyway, as the station gets bigger, it'll obviously reflect more light. And I'm wondering, as we move on into the future and more installations are put into orbit, are perhaps advertisers going to get the idea of putting billboards and signs up there? Is the beauty of our night sky in jeopardy?
Oh,
and I got
grown.
One more question.
Okay, ask both questions, and then I'll answer them both.
The second one is this perhaps a mistake to be building a space station at all? Wouldn't it be making more sense to ship everything up to the moon and build a permanent installation up there?
Okay. First question, brightness of the space station.
Yeah, as for the first one, that's a great question. And although I have not tried to go out and see the space station myself, it should be very bright. It should be approximately as bright as Venus, which at many times, I've had reported to me as a UFO. So it should be quite spectacular to look at. Even the space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope look like moving bright stars in the sky if you know just where to see them. Now, because they orbit more or less over the equator, from here in Chicago, they're usually not too high in the sky. But I think that's something I'll take as homework, and I'll research the orbit of the new space station and give our listeners a report just where to see, because it should be bright. I have followed the shuttle with binoculars, with a small telescope, and it's quite a striking sight. As for the ads question, that's a very good question, because it has been proposed. Okay? I know of three, to put things in orbit deliberately to attract attention. The least benign was a proposal of the Soviets to light up all of Siberia by putting these sort of like balloons, giant silver balloons in orbit and inflating them. They would be reflectors, and they were to be constructed to shine, reflect the sun's light down on Siberia and be much, much brighter than the full moon. I think that would be a catastrophe. In addition to the fact you'd never see the stars again, think of what it would do to the rhythms of all the animals, of the people that have developed over hundreds of thousands, millions of years. We're sort of used to day and night. I don't think it would be a great idea to try and abolish the night, but that was proposed, and fortunately they ran out of money to do that. One other proposal I know of was an artistic proposal from France to celebrate perhaps the millennium by putting the equivalent of the Eiffel Tower, a giant ring, in orbit. And everyone would see this ring. It would be, you know, like the moon is white and solid. This would be an artistic ring in orbit forever. And I don't know what stopped that project, but something stopped it. And that's okay by me.
What about the question of building a space station on the moon instead of in orbit?
You know, I think we are tied to what's called low Earth orbit. Many people may not realize that space station is only 300 miles up. It's considerably closer to our listeners than New York is, or Pennsylvania. And that's because the space shuttle can easily visit things in low Earth orbit. And the station was always designed to be assembled and maintained by the shuttle, and the shuttle is what we've got nowadays for going to orbit. So until there is another space transportation system besides the shuttle, I think we have to build everything close to home.
All right, George, thanks very much for your questions. 312-832-3124 is our number. Let's talk with Carol. Good morning, Carol. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Well, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
I love to take pictures of the sunrise and the sunsets, and I've been doing this for years, and I heard it said that you shouldn't be looking through your binoculars at the sun. Now I'm wondering if I should be looking through the viewer in my camera when I'm taking pictures of sunsets and sunrises.
You know, that's an excellent question. As long as you restrict yourself to sunrise and sunset, Carol, you should be fine. A camera collects light just like binoculars do. And so if the sun was higher in the sky, it would be a danger. In fact, I heard one time somebody burned the focal plane shutter of their 35-millimeter camera trying to take pictures of the sun. If you can burn your camera, you could burn your eye. The thing that protects us is what's really dangerous to the eye is the ultraviolet. And the atmosphere of the Earth tends to scatter blue light and ultraviolet light a lot. And the red light and orange light is what goes right through the atmosphere without scattering very much. That's the reason why sunset looks orange. I'm smiling because this was on the final exam of my students yesterday at the university. Why is the sky blue and why is the sunset red? And the answer is the same. That blue light and ultraviolet light also, which is dangerous, scatters a lot. And so when the sunlight comes through, the blue light scatters sideways and makes the sky blue. The red and orange light continues through to your eye. So the atmosphere is protecting you. The most dangerous radiation, the blue and the violet and the ultraviolet, are scattering. And when the sun is low in the sky and it's going through a lot of atmosphere, all of that dangerous light is pretty much scattered out. By the way, that's also why when you buy glasses, sunglasses, if you're skiing or shooting, they're always rose-colored or orange-colored or red-colored, and that's because they allow you to see the light that goes through the atmosphere sharply and clearly without scattering. If you ever put on blue sunglasses, everything would look very blurry.
All right, Carol, thanks very much for your question. 312-832-3124. Let's talk to Amy. Good morning, Amy. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hi. I also had the wonderful pleasure of seeing Aurora Borealis this summer on the Oregon coast just by chance. And I tried to get some explanations of it and how it was related to this 11-year sunspot cycle, but nothing that I read was something digestible. So I wondered if you could sort of try to explain this in some digestible way for me.
Sure, I'll be happy to, and I'll also remind our listeners that on the webpage, astro.uchicago.edu, I have links to a number of things auroral, and I'm putting some more links on. There's a satellite now whose only job is to orbit over the poles and look down and watch as the aurora strikes the Earth and study it and warn us all about it. It turns out that the material that's shot off the sun, like I was saying before, the sun is hot enough. Mostly it's made of hydrogen, and so atoms of hydrogen get shot through space, but the sun's hot enough that the protons and the electrons have broken apart, and so the positive and negative charges are sort of separate. So the wind from the sun, what I'm trying to say, is charged. The Earth has a magnetic field which can bend the path of charged particles. So when the solar wind and other material comes toward the Earth, the poles, the north and south magnetic poles, are where it heads toward, basically. So the reason you see the aurora mostly around the poles is because that it's coming from the sun, it's charged, and the Earth has a magnetic field. So all this stuff comes into the atmosphere, it's moving very fast, it hits the gases high in our atmosphere, 50 or 100 miles up, and it's just like the inside of a fluorescent light. Inside a fluorescent light is a stream of electrons that hit the gases and transfer energy to them and make them glow. And for anyone who wants to be really technical out there, fluorescent means that you get hit by something not visible, if you're an atom, and then change that energy to visible light. So for instance, some minerals, you may have seen this at a museum, if you shine ultraviolet light on them, you can't see that energy going into the minerals, but they suddenly glow really brightly under an ultraviolet light. Some posters, I'm dating myself, but some posters, you know, under so-called black lights, which really mean ultraviolet lights, also glow. And that's the phenomenon of fluorescence, converting the energy into visible light.
Now, why again does it happen at the North Pole?
Because the material from the sun has its trajectory bent or curved by the Earth's magnetic field. And sort of you can think of the particles being guided in by the field. They actually don't
only
hit
the North Pole, not the South
no,
Pole.
No, the South Pole. And a wonderful thing is these satellite pictures show that whenever the North Pole lights up, the South Pole lights up simultaneously.
Because that's just when a lot of stuff is coming?
Absolutely. It's these wonderful pictures from space.
Very interesting. All right, Amy, I hope that answered your question. 312-832-3124 is our number. Let's talk to Sean. Good morning, Sean. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, when you're viewing stars in either the evening or the first morning, when they're low to the horizon, sometimes you can see like a cycle changing of lights, like their color is changing at a regular interval. Have you ever observed that?
I have. I actually see it not quite so much as a regular interval, but I would describe it more as a flickering or an irregular interval. And in a pair of binoculars, I see that even much more than with just my eye. And
the fact is when you describe the this is just the refraction of light through the atmosphere. Is that what's causing that effect?
It is, and the fact that the different colors of light are affected differently. So, for instance, blue light and red light and green light will be bent by slightly different amounts going through the atmosphere. And so what started out as pure white light of an untwinkling star will change itself into a cycle of first you'll see a little orange, then a little green. When the star is right close to the horizon, especially if it's a bright star, I often see colors. And the reason is indeed our atmosphere.
All right, Sean, thanks very much for your call. 312...
Gretchen, I'll just add to Sean's comment. As long as we're talking, and the other listeners, talking about seeing things near the horizon, and the one woman was talking about photographing the sunrise and the sunset, I should remind all our listeners there's a particularly beautiful sunsets over the next month in Chicago, and that's because about 6 p.m., just when it gets dark, out in the east, we have the really bright object out there is Jupiter. And just above Jupiter is a little cluster of stars called the Pleiades or the Seven Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And just to the right of the Pleiades is the planet Saturn. So you have a very pretty grouping. And when it's clear like this, if you're hardy, look out in the east at sunset. And that's what you're seeing.
And the Pleiades, as I learned from you just recently, are actually brighter and more easily perceptible from the corners of your eyes.
Yes, if you ever want to see anything faint, either in the sky or for that matter, if you're a detective out at night and you're spying on somebody, or you just want to make your way where it's dark and not stumble, probably most listeners have discovered this, sort of accidentally on their own. If you stare at something, it tends to disappear. If you catch it out of the corner of your eye, you can see it better at night, and that's because the periphery of your eye is actually more sensitive.
So the Pleiades look sort of like individual points of stars when you look directly at them. And then if you look at them from the corners of your eyes, it looks like a sort of fluffier cluster-looking thing.
Most people can see about 6 stars if they're looking from a dark location. You know, from downtown Chicago, you probably, I don't know how many you'd see. With a pair of binoculars, I can see 30.
Oh, yeah, there's a whole mess of them. They look like a neat little pattern. And then you look through binoculars, and it's a mess.
That's right. And if you want to notice colors of stars, by the way, we've described there's Jupiter below the Pleiades. Go down a little bit more, and there's a star called Aldebaran, the Eye of the Bull. And it is about an equal distance below Jupiter that the Pleiades is above. And all of these are about 3 fist widths held out at arm's length above the horizon at 6 p.m.
All right. Let's take some more calls. 312-832-3124. Let's talk to Joan. Good morning, Joan. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hi. About 5 years ago, I took some pictures of another a phenomenon near sunset, and they were blue and pink rays that just kind of went over the whole horizon. I talked to one of the weathermen on one of the channels, I think it was Channel 5, and he said they were crepuscular rays. Can you tell us of crepuscular rays? I don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
That's what I saw, you know.
I would love to be able to answer that question. Although I've heard of crepuscular waves, I have not seen them myself. And to be honest, I can't tell you what they are. Most of the unusual things that you see, like you're describing, are actually caused by ice crystals in clouds high up in the atmosphere. And there is a wonderful book, which somewhat ironically I have purchased but not read yet, which is called Rainbows, Halos, and Glories. And each one of those things are something that's seen in the sky. Various kinds of rays, a very strange phenomenon called the specter of the bracken, which I guess is only seen in Ireland or Scotland, wherever the bracken is found.
Would this maybe happen late at night after one's been visiting a pub?
Might possibly. One time when I was in a plane, I looked and I saw the shadow of the plane following us on the ground, and it had like a rainbow outline, and I had not been drinking on that flight. So I wish I could tell you, and I apologize for not, but I do recommend the book called Rainbows, Halos, and Glories, which will tell you what that was.
All right, Joan, thanks for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Tom. Good morning, Tom. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Good morning. I have a couple of quick questions on the increase, the solar max activity. Does that affect navigation systems, for air travel? And the second question would be, if you're in an airplane and being exposed to this, are you exposed to more radiations or other effects because of the 12-year cycle?
Interesting.
Two good questions. I should say I'm not expert on either, but I know something about both of them. There is the possibility of some of these solar emissions affecting satellites. We try and build satellites, actually, and especially their computer memories, to be hardened or fairly strong against various kinds of radiation, because there's always some coming from the sun. There's even cosmic rays, which are atoms shot off from other parts of the galaxy. Every once in a while, a satellite takes a hit in one of its computer memories and it fails. That happened to the Hubble Space Telescope. That's one reason why we like to have things in low Earth orbit and the astronauts can go in and repair them, put in a new memory chip or something like that. When it comes to air travel, in part you're shielded by the atmosphere, but not entirely. And the higher in the atmosphere you are, the less you're shielded. So the people who are most at risk are the astronauts. And if you're going to be up at altitude or in space for months and months, then I think it becomes a serious risk. If you're only flying occasionally, it's not a risk. I do know that for the Concorde plane, one of the things they worried about fairly seriously was, would this be a significant health risk to the pilots? But with the exception of the recent unfortunate accident, the Concorde has flown safely. The pilots that I've dealt with personally have not had any health problems from this. So I think it is a risk potentially, but in practice, not to worry about it.
All right, Tom, thanks for your call. Let's see if we can fit another call in before the end of the hour. Let's talk to Mick. Good morning, Mick. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Yes, I had an experience also in the Dakotas. I think I was in North Dakota on the interstate going westward, and I noticed in the sky what looked like a curtain of light, which I understood was, of course, the Aurora Borealis. But I noticed that it seemed to curve, and it was a vertical cylinder that I felt was centered on the Earth's north magnetic pole. A couple of months later, I don't remember the source, but there was a photograph, this is 1984, I believe, from a satellite showing this very thing, but from the perspective of being high enough to look onto the northern portion of the Earth as a sphere, and you could see this kind of ring circling the Earth as a continuous wall of what we'll call it light in this case.
Absolutely right. The most dramatic pictures and this satellite, which I guess I'm really going to have to link to the webpage we mentioned, show that where the aurora comes down the strongest is not right at the pole, but it's a giant oval, and it's just sort of like a cylinder sticking up from the planet, just like you said. And the footprint of that, where it hits the ground, where the aurora is by far the most intense, goes through Fairbanks, Alaska, Yellowknife, Canada, swings on around all the way into Finland. And so for this trip that I'm leading in March, I've chosen to go to Yellowknife in Canada. And we stay in a beautiful lodge. Nobody's there except for a bunch of reindeer and us, and the lights. And because we're right underneath this oval, every single night the lights come out. And that's what just blew me away last year, that it wasn't just that you could sometimes see the beautiful lights, but virtually every night.
But you can see it from the rest of the globe as well if you continued west from Fairbanks, if you went over into...
The stronger the sun's activity, the further south the auroral oval comes. So since we're at solar maximum, there's a possibility of it coming all the way down to Chicago. And as a matter of fact, at the previous solar maximum in 1980, I saw the aurora over Tucson, Arizona. And not only was it like a shimmering curtain like this gentleman described, this aurora was red. I came outside one of the telescopes I was looking at. I looked off in the distance at Tucson, and for a full 2, 3, 4 seconds, I believed it was World War III, because there was a giant red glow over all of Tucson. So it can come that far south, but that's pretty rare.
Okay, Mick, thanks very much for your call. Doug, why don't you give us your website again if people want to see pictures
of
the sun?
Okay, that is astro.uchicago.edu/Duncan.
And what should they look for on the website?
Oh, all kinds of things. I mean, things about the Christmas Day eclipse, things about the aurora, things about the trip to the aurora, things about the next total eclipse in Africa. It's all there together.
Okay, and if you didn't catch that address, you can get there from our website, which is WBEZ.org. And when you get to BEZ's homepage, click on Today on WBEZ, Today at WBEZ. Click on that, and you'll get the link to Doug Duncan's webpage. Yep.
Any way that listeners can get toward the north, extreme to Canada with me, or on your own to South Dakota, like several listeners, or Upper Michigan, keep your eyes open all this winter. It'll be beautiful when the aurora comes.
All right. Doug Duncan is Associate Professor of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much.
My pleasure as always, Gretchen.
Merry eclipse.
Thank you.
Thanks to Joshua Andrews for producing and directing. Thanks to Veronica Williams for engineering. Thanks to everyone who called, and apologies to those whose calls we didn't get to. Tomorrow we're going to take a little detour into the meaning of life, Aristotle, Freud, and the ethical life. Join us for that. Worldview with Jerome McDonnell is up next. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Yo-ho, it's hot. The sun is not a place where we could live, but here on Earth there'd be no life without the light it gives. We need its light, we need its heat, we need its energy. Without the sun, without a doubt, there'd be no